Hi, I'm Jennifer Vine, President and CEO of the Education Foundation of Sarasota County, and your host for Education Conversations, a discussion forum to share innovative and relevant thoughts, research, and ideas on education today, and to help prepare students to thrive. Welcome to this episode of Education Conversations, Our Students Today, a Neuroscience Perspective. While there has always been some interest in neuroscience and education, I think the timing of this topic has never been more relevant and critical than right now. Today, we're going to explore cognitive neuroscience and how brain structures influence how we process information. But going a little bit deeper, we're going to go look at the impact trauma can have on brain chemistry, behavior, and learning, specifically for students. We'll be joined today by licensed school psychologist Dr. Stacy Herrera, who I adore deeply, and I think you all will too. I first met Stacy in 2018 when we hosted the screening of the film Screenagers, a documentary that focuses on the effects of screen time on teenagers, and Stacy was one of the panelists. And in talking with each other, we instantly connected. She has just a brilliant mind and a great way of relating and understanding things that are happening in today's world. And so we have continued to put our heads together on the many ideas and projects involving education in our students, and I'm certain we're going to continue to do so. Dr. Herrera owns a successful private practice in Osprey, which is a little suburb of Sarasota, Florida, and being a true innovator, she partnered with schools here locally to develop a telehealth platform to provide mental health support for middle and high school students. I consider Stacy to be a valued friend and a colleague, and I'm thrilled that she is here today to share her knowledge in this area. Stacy, welcome to Education Conversations.
Jennifer, thank you so much, one, for that introduction and the heartwarming feelings and of knowing that our collaborations have not only been synergistic in a way, but really led to some innovation in supporting youth in our community. So excited to have this conversation today. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And I'm so glad you're a part of it. And to all of you in the community who is listening, I think what's also really encouraging is how we're always looking for the intersection and partnerships of unique relationships. And Dr. Herrera certainly is one of those gems in our community. Okay, we're going to go ahead and just dive in, Stacy, and I want to quote from your recent blog. You cited that statistics indicate that mental health-related emergency room visits for children ages 5 to 11 increased an astonishing 24% early in the pandemic from the prior year, and that 44% of high school students reported persistent feelings of sadness and hopelessness. We're seeing things we've not seen before and viewing this as a new baseline. I know it's a little bit of a broad area, but can you give us an overview of neuroscience and why it's relevant to our students?
So I think the impact that we're seeing on youth right now is seen within those statistics. With regards to neuroscience and how we're looking at the brain and understanding how the brain is digesting all of the information and experiences that the youth are having at this time, I think we can look at it in twofold and then see how it comes together and how we're seeing the behavioral and emotional changes within our youth and how they're managing everything that's coming at them. We know that there are developmental milestones for all of us, really, as we're growing older. And what's happening is that students are, and youth in general, are being exposed to things at an earlier and earlier age. And then in addition to that, due to the advances in medicine, children are being born that may not have survived in the past, right? We have, statistically speaking, more students who are being born earlier than they should be and may have more complications. So we're looking at a generation in which we have all of these medical advancements, and yet the brain development, the neuroscience behind their journey, if you will, is really hitting some roadblocks, hitting some opportunities for us to invest more time in their care, and it feels overwhelming because of the number of students that are entering kindergarten who have experienced not only significant trauma, but maybe delayed in some way. We have teenagers who have experienced significant trauma, and the level of hopelessness that was recorded in those statistics is just really negatively impacting their ability to learn and to be able to show up and perform in a way that we would expect given their age.
That's I'm trying to process, even as you're talking through all of this, what that really means. And so correct me if I interpreted this incorrectly, but it sounds like the medical advancements are going at a faster rate than the brain is able to adapt to those changes. So the children are having some different types of struggles that they once did not experience. Did I interpret that correctly or not?
I think a way of understanding is I'm often asked why this particular generation is struggling so much. Mm. And so if we look at this particular generation, the medical advancements that I'm thinking of are those in which have allowed them to live longer, mm-hmm. given certain diagnoses, that have allowed them to survive mm-hmm. certain traumas or experiences or disasters because we have the medical advances. Mm-hmm. And yet we are not catching up in a way to be able to say, well, they survived that, right? Medically speaking, we were able to support them. They survived that. But then how do we support them emotionally? How do we look at how the brain has digested those experiences and or managed any kind of chronic illness that youth may be experiencing at this time?
That's really informative. So let's go a little bit further on the trauma then. And I know it's a pretty broad area, but what does trauma look like and how does it affect the brain?
So I think often individuals think of trauma as kind of the big T trauma, if you will. A traumatic experience that really puts an individual in a place that is life-threatening or threatening to their body in some way that puts them in this hyper-aware space of being extremely unsafe. And then we also need to look at what we call little t trauma, and not to minimize that, but it can be a collection of small experiences that leave someone feeling dysregulated or emotionally vulnerable over time. So collectively, if we look back at Hurricane Ian that occurred this last year, we see that there were traumatic experiences, but everyone experienced it in a different scale, right? It may have been extremely traumatic for someone who was trapped in their home during the storm as flood levels were rising. We're in a big T trauma experience, understanding that they were in a life-threatening situation. For those of us that were outside of the eye of the storm, the little T trauma of having to sit inside and hear the wind as if a train were coming towards the house for an extended period of time and having everyone in this heightened aware space and then not really talking about how we all collectively experienced those particular days and the days afterwards of energy insecurity, being displaced potentially, just all of the insecurities that came after the hurricane. And if we're not talking through those and allowing the brain to digest them, they become traumatic experiences that then in the future may impact our functioning. And if we've had a series of those little T traumas over time, we see that the little bodies just can't contain them anymore. They're going to come out in behaviors. And so with the pandemic and then with the hurricane afterwards, I know we saw quite an increase in behaviors within the educational setting. And it's just their way of expressing that they can't contain all of the uncertainty and dysregulation that they're feeling any longer.
So how does a student regulate based on that? So for instance, you made a comment about talking through it, mm-hmm. and that's a way for the brain to maybe process and heal?
Most definitely.
Okay. What are the conditions that a student needs to therapeutically go through that process so the brain is on that healing place?
So the therapies can occur when someone's functioning is negatively impacted and their behaviors are not manageable, and the parents or caregivers and teachers have exhausted all of their tools within their toolbox. I think there are opportunities prior to therapy for individuals to be able to talk through experiences and to understand that it's okay and that we were all in this together, and that what you experienced and how you were processing the moment and how your emotions came out is okay, because part of being human is going through all of the emotions. And to be able to say to a child, I understand why you're crying right now. I understand why you're angry right now. What you're feeling makes sense to what you've experienced. And it allows them to feel this one sense of connection, right? Feeling heard and seen and valued. And then also an opportunity to go, oh, you mean it's quote unquote normal to feel this way? Because I know that I have a number of clients who come into therapy and they're wanting to feel normal. Mm. And if we begin to have conversations around emotions and that the full range of emotions can be normal given particular experiences, it helps everyone to say, okay, now I get it. Now I can move forward. Mm-hmm. If that simple conversation, allowing the child to really understand that, one, it's normal, two, we as adults in the room understand how to move forward and continue to create certainty and safety for them, then they're allowed to be children. They're mm-hmm. allowed to just move through it. And if we as adults are unsettled ourselves, we don't have all the answers, our cups are empty, for lack of a better mm-hmm. term, and we snap back at the children and we say, don't cry, don't be angry, don't feel how you're feeling given this experience, we're denying and dismissing the fact that they need to process through those emotions. And they're also seeing then potentially caregivers and adults as humans who don't have it all together, who can't create certainty. And because then they don't have the answers, then I as a child have to try and figure things out. I have to be more hypervigilant. I have to go in and make sure that the caregivers are okay. I have to somehow grow up and mature really fast, which then doesn't allow for that processing and may create coping skills that then aren't going to serve that individual later in life.
That's very helpful information. I'm curious to know if you have any quick tips, not that I think there's always just a fast fix for many of these things, but for those caregivers or family members whose cup is empty and who is also dealing with incredible stress, what are the tips you would share to them of things that they should be thinking about just so that they are building their own toolbox as well?
I think that the best tip is for caregivers or parents to really create their own village of support so that then they can be a source of support to their children. If that's not possible, if we as adults can remember, it only takes 5 minutes to connect with that child and give them reassurance. So if we can somehow put in a container all of the things that are going wrong, but sit and listen for 5 minutes with the child and really connect and say, I want to hear what your experience is. I want to know what you're feeling. I want to understand how you're processing all of this information. It can really make a difference. And then if your child sees you in a state where you are completely emotional, completely dysregulated, then for you to be able to say, I'm human too. And I'm having a hard time right now, but know that I, as a mom, I'm managing the best that I can right now. And know that your job as a child is just to tell me how you're doing and to let me figure it out as we move forward. Once a child knows that there is someone looking out for their safety and interests, they can feel this sense of calm and ease. And then they're able to better digest everything that's going on around them.
helpful information. You also said that in a very calming way, too. So you have mastered the art of providing therapy. I can see that. I'm getting pulled into your conversation just listening to you. I'm curious also if, for those of who's listening right now, you know, while the Education Foundation really isn't necessarily in the mental health space, we very much care about ensuring each and every student can thrive.
Yes.
So there is a piece of a student's well-being that's really important. And I think your practice went into recognizing a missing link in the response and availability to provide resources. So can you touch on a little bit about your telehealth support that you are now offering?
Certainly. So as a licensed school psychologist, I not only have a private practice, but I was supporting charter schools in the area. And due to the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas tragedy, there was some legislation that came down that mandated that schools had a mental health plan in place. The second rendition or guidance that the state was providing in 2019 indicated that we could use telehealth in order to provide services within this mental health plan. And it sparked an idea for me. If we're using technology to connect instead of disconnect, we're using it in a beautiful way. So what if we were able to connect more clinicians with more students who are at risk or potentially at risk during the school day using telehealth? Then schools can connect a student with a very specialized therapist, not necessarily the one that's available in the school, but someone who has training in an area that's really valuable to that student at that particular time. So we piloted in the fall of 2019. We had done all of the research, had all of the wisdom behind us in order to roll out telehealth within a school, a local school here in Sarasota County. And we had a little challenge in convincing everyone that telehealth was just as effective as in-person therapy. And then March of 2020 happened, and we all know that a number of businesses converted to really working virtually, and ours was no different. We had, of course, done the research and had all the policies and procedures in place, and so we're instantly available to move to those telehealth options. And then you and I had a conversation, recognizing that the schools were so overwhelmed with trying to understand how to deliver remote lessons for students and to allow every student to access all of those remote lessons, the social emotional pieces of school were kind of put to the side for the moment. And so you and I began to think about how would we make it possible to have telehealth options with youth-focused nonprofits. So if they are within the community, actually engaging with the youth and seeing some of the stressors and the heaviness that this generation is carrying, how could they engage with the therapeutic process, but still not have the mission of being a mental health focused right. practice? And so I loved your challenge at that time where you said, okay, but it can't be ongoing. So I went back to the research and found that the single session therapy model was such a beautiful way of connecting with individuals and reducing the wait time, and had all of this great research behind it with regards to efficacy. And we developed the 90-minute wellness check-in. And we piloted it with students that were coming through the Ed Foundation, and recognizing that concentrated 90 minutes with two therapists really allowed these students to get their feet underneath them. We do a 30-minute check-in the week after to say, hey, how did those strategies go? We're providing them with a one-pager to refer to that has strategies that were discussed, as well as community connections and resources for those individuals. And it was such a beautiful way of shifting into this idea of, it's not only the school's responsibility. We as a community need to step up and support the emotional health of youth.
Yeah, that's a great illustration, and it's been a great partnership, Stacy. You're so brilliant in being ahead of something that we, none of us thought about with that pandemic, and you all were poised to do that. These services, for those of you who are listening, are still available, and we certainly will have those resources available at the end of the show so we can direct you all to that. But it's been an innovative pilot that I think is certainly breeding some success. You touched on the emotional, social-emotional development of children, and I'm curious to learn your thoughts on how you see the integration of that with neuroscience. How does all of those separate pieces actually integrate together so that students can thrive?
When I think about the neuroscience behind our development or the development of youth, I think about the attachment and the connection that children have with a primary caregiver. And I think back to grad school, in which they showed us a particular experiment in which a mother sat across from their child, and the child was in a high chair, if you can visualize this, and the mother was sitting across from the child. And the mother initially was extremely engaging, where you're making eye contact and you're using your hands and you're connecting with that child. And as that child is then smiling back at mom and really lit up, you can see the facial expressions within that child, and you can see the connections being formed. And in that moment, that child is open and available to learning, according to neuroscience. And you can see that. And then in the next moment, you see the mother go extremely flat in her facial expressions, and you see the child attempting to get the attention of the mom. First, you see the child like giggling or attempting to be social and pro-social and engaging with the mom, and the mom just does not respond. And then you see the child get a little bit unsettled, a little, just whimpering a little bit, if you will. Mom still does not respond. Then you see the child go to a complete and utter meltdown, where they are crying hysterically to get mom's attention. So if we know that that's how the brain is processing situations in order to connect with others, because we know that that is so important for us as humans, to have that connection within our community, within our family, because it keeps us safe. So it's through these connections that we're available to learning. So going back to what you had asked, if we're looking at development and neuroscience and social emotional learning, it's really important that everyone understands the developmental milestones, what a child should be capable of at certain ages, what's age appropriate. For example, I have parents come in and talk about, well, they're lying. The child is lying. Oftentimes, that's a developmental milestone. They are attempting to see if they say something that the caregiver wants to hear, right? Or they're attempting to see if I say something and it gets me out of trouble, how is this going to play out as I move forward? It's important for them to go through that phase. And yet we see it as a maladaptive behavior, right? Something we don't want within our children. But to recognize that there are developmental stages that children must flow through in order for them to be productive and just a better connector within our community. And so right now, we have a huge delay in social skills. It's largely due to the pandemic, not only because children were isolated, but because the social norms became different. Children weren't out and about in the community having these novel interactions with the cashiers or with someone at a birthday party or just being out at a park and engaging with other people. We were attempting during the pandemic to keep everyone safe and healthy. And what it transpired into is this social skills delay that because that particular cohort of children hasn't had those experiences, we are now going to have to teach them how to sit still, how to engage with others, and how to be open to learning. And if we recognize that we have to go backwards, right, and teach connections, that in preschool, the focus should be on just that, being able to regulate, being able to connect, and then we'll worry about the academics later. Because if we don't have that in place, if we don't have students who can sit and listen and interact with others, then our traditional school or way of schooling is not going to work.
Stacy, you've provided very reflective, introspective, and strong thinking in all of this that is certainly research-based. And in your proven years of being a highly successful school psychologist, thank you so much for sharing these insights. And it certainly gives us lots of things to think about as the Education Foundation explores new ways to support students and to help them thrive. And I think just touching on the social emotional development of the students, and that is something that is probably at a critical level right now. That's something that the community at large certainly can give thought and consideration to, ways in which we can help support the students and their families and caregivers so that they can be successful in their school days. So we're going to wrap up today's podcast, and certainly you may want to find out more about Dr. Stacy Herrera and her wonderful work that she's doing, and you can visit her website at drstacyherrera.com, and please note that it is Stacy with a S-T-A-C-I-E, Herrera, H-E-R-R-E-R-A, and definitely get involved with us as well. We always want to hear from our listeners, and we encourage you to learn more about our resources and programs available through the Education Foundation at www.edfoundationsrq.org. We appreciate you all so much for listening to today's podcast, and be sure to tune in to our other episodes of Education Conversations. For now, this is Jennifer Vine signing off for the Education Foundation of Sarasota County.